All right, we're in finishing chapter 18, and we're going to move all the way through 19, verse 12. What is in chapter 18? Why is that chapter significant in the Gospel of Matthew? Yes, that is right. It is the fourth major discourse. What is it about? What? Yes, children being the greatest. So it starts talking about initially value system in the kingdom of God, which is a significant conversation coming off of what precedes it. The whole idea of the way in which Jesus functions as not being something valuable because he keeps talking about dying and all that fun stuff, right? The temple tax comes up. They basically challenge the identity of Jesus through the temple tax by asking how come he has to pay for it if he is an official rabbi. But he is an official rabbi according to their kingdom. But his kingdom functions off of a different value system. A value system in which children, parasites of society, are actually the greatest in the kingdom. What is that followed up by? After verse 14. Church discipline. We're talking about community, not just value system within a community, but also if we value this community, how do we protect each other in this community? And he basically talks about a way of doing church discipline. You go one-on-one, you go multiple people at once. If the person is still in sin, you bring him before the church. And what you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. And we talked about, I don't know if we talked about it in as much, but detail in class, but out of class. It's not an easy teaching. It's not an easy practice. It's one that I've had to experience probably 3 or 4 different times already. I mean, it happens. How many times were people restored out of that? So far, 1.5. And I say a half because I'm kind of still waiting for one to pan out and see how it works. Is it easy? Never. You want to talk about sleepless nights in ministry? It usually has something to do with Matthew 18. It's the worst. Having to tell somebody, hey, you need to get your act together. And this is about the 8th time I've talked to you about this. Because what you're doing is not acceptable in the kingdom of God. I'm sorry. Your sexual sin will be dealt with. I'm not going to sit by and just let you do it over and over and over. I'm not going to let you treat your wife like trash. Not going to happen. If you do, you're going to be dismissed from the community. That's the way it has to work. These are tough conversations, especially whenever things start being thrown at you, literally. They become very difficult, especially when they're your close friends. And you wake up at night thinking, how could I set them outside of the community? But right here, the word that's consistently being used is brother. This is a family language talk. It's never easy. But it's one that you do because you really love the person, that you're trying to give them grace. And whenever they don't understand what comes with that grace, that's just something that you have to deal with. So now we're moving on. In light of that conversation, the difficult conversation of ways in which we rebuke our brothers, and yet the goal is ultimately to restore them, Peter pops up with a question in verse 21. Oh, good Peter. Then Peter came to Jesus and asked, Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother when he forgives against me? Up to 7 times? In other words, he's asking, when is it complete? When is my forgiveness complete? When is it done? When do I look at a person and just say, you can never repent, you're out of the community, you're done? You see what he's asking? He's saying, do I do it? Like, what is the complete number? What is the 7th time? Like, how many times do I really need to be forgiving someone? That's actually a pretty good question. And the reason why I say that is because, man, when you are in ministry, good grief, you have some people that you're like, seriously? Seriously? We're still dealing with the same one again, but they keep coming back. And so Jesus answers him with he says something and then he gives him a parable. Verse 22, Jesus answered, I tell you not 7 times, but 77 times. What's he saying? Completeness, 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 completeness. 11 sevens. 11 sevens. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like. Where have we heard that before? Yes, 13. Six times in chapter 13, by the way. The kingdom of heaven is like a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. As he began the settlement, a man who owed him 10,000 talents was brought to him. Since he was not able to pay the master, the master ordered that he and his wife and his children and all that he had be sold to repay the debt. Did you hear what was being sold? All of his property. And what does that include? His wife and his kids. See that? Sorry, ladies. That'll actually come up important here in just a bit when we start talking about divorce, too. Sell everything you've got to pay it back. Because if you don't sell everything you got, this guy's not going to be able to pay it back. The servant fell on his knees before him. "Be patient with me," he begged, "and I will pay back everything." The servant's master took pity on him, canceled the debt, and let him go. Grace. He said, "You know what? You would have to sell absolutely everything to pay this back. You would. Even your wife and kids." And that's literal. That's not a figure of speech. But he goes, "You know what? You're good. You're good. Move on. Just get out of here. You're fine." But when that servant went out, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii. Now that's no small amount. 100 denarii is no small amount. That's 100 days' wages. That's 1/3 of a year's pay. But compared to what he owed, it's minute. 100 denarii. He grabbed him and began to choke him. "Pay back what you owe me." I don't know why, but every time I read that verse, I always picture Homer Simpson. I don't know why. But just like the grabbing and the choking and the... Anyway. He grabbed him and began to choke him. "Pay back what you owe me," he demanded. Oh, man. His fellow servant fell to his knees and begged him, "Be patient with me and I will pay you back." What's significant about that phrase right there? Exact same phrase that he said before. Exactly the same one. But he refused. Instead, he went off and had the man thrown into prison until he could pay the debt. When the other servants saw what had happened, they were greatly distressed and went and told their master everything that had happened. Then the master called the servant in. "You wicked servant," he said. "I canceled all that debt of yours because you begged me to. Shouldn't you have had mercy on your fellow servant just as I had on you?" In anger, his master turned him over to the jailers to be tortured until he should pay back all he owed. Long time of torturing, my friends. This is how my Heavenly Father will treat each of you unless you forgive your brother from your heart. What is this saying about the community? If this is the last thing that is at the fourth major discourse about the community, let's sum up. What is it saying about the community? Start at the beginning of chapter 18 and trace me through to the end of chapter 18. Or, maybe let me ask it this way. This is the same question you should be asking for your exegetical paper, which we need to talk about. I was talking to somebody, Caleb, I forgot. We need to talk about your exegeticals and how those need to go down. But the question I want you to ask is this last section, verse 21 all the way through verse 35. If that was not there, what would we be missing? What would be left out of this discussion? Is this a dumb question or is this Tuesday or what? Like, am I audible? What's going on? Holler if you hear me. Yes, go ahead. Yeah.
But I don't know, it just kind of goes after like the discipline of the church, so like that grace.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. We've been talking about a value. The value system of the kingdom is upside down. And so they're thinking, okay, well, if you don't value dietary laws, maybe we can just do whatever we want. I mean, if the value system, if children are the greatest, then we can just be selfish, pestilent children and just do whatever we want. And then he comes along and says, no, hold on, you can't do whatever you want. As a matter of fact, if your brother sins against you, this is what you're supposed to do. And then eventually what he says is, if your brother keeps on sinning, you kick him out. You treat him like a pagan or a tax collector. And they're like, sounds good. He's like, now hold on. Hold on. We also have to add another element into this equation. It's called grace. And this is what defines our community. We are an upside down community where what the world values, we don't value. But it doesn't mean we're anarchists. It doesn't mean that we have no value at all. We do have things we value, and the ways in which we act, the fruit that we produce, is something we pay attention to. And so that's where the church discipline concept comes in. Our community needs to advance, the kingdom needs to advance through the ways in which we produce fruit. And if someone is producing things that are not positive for the community, they need to be disciplined. But don't go around just looking to kick somebody out. Because if that's the way you're going to function, God's going to function the same way with you. You see how this all makes sense? Nice little bow at the top. Bam. Tied. Moving on. Right? Good. I got it. So I guess that means we're moving. Okay. Chapter 19, verse 1. When Jesus had finished saying these things, why is that significant? It's the fourth time I've asked that question about a phrase. Kind of like this one. What's that? Yes. Every single major discourse ends with this phrase. When Jesus had finished saying these things, when he had finished, da 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 da. As a matter of fact, that you can find in Matthew chapter 7, verse 28, 11, verse 1, 13, 53, 19, 1, 26, 1. 7, 28, 11, 1, 13, 53, 19, 1, 26, 1. Five different times this same phrase occurs. Five different times after he finished saying these things. What we're going to be launching into now here in Matthew chapter 19 is three different interactions with Jesus in a particular group. Jesus in some sort of group or some sort of person. Some sort of interaction with Jesus. All three interactions, this is very important. All three interactions emphasize the disciples not getting it. They just blow it. Every one of them, they blow it. The very first one, we're going to have an interaction between the Pharisees and Jesus about divorce. And in verse 10, the disciples seem to basically be opting for what the Pharisees say about divorce. They're kind of like, whoa, man, if what you're saying is right, Jesus, it'd be better not to ever get married anyway. And Jesus look at me and say, you know what? Some of you idiots, that's right. You should never get married because you're a moron. But we'll get to that in a minute. Then little children come to Jesus in 19, 13 through 15. But what do the disciples try and do? They try to keep him away. Get away, little children. You're little parasites. Right after Jesus had just talked about who's the greatest in the kingdom. Then the final interaction would be the rich young man and Jesus. And at the very end, the disciples ask the insightful question, well, if he can't get in, who can? Every time. In all three of these interactions, the disciples are showing they still don't get it. And frankly, when we're only about five or six, well, actually, we're only two chapters away from Jerusalem, and about seven chapters away from the trials and Jesus' crucifixion, that's kind of disturbing. They've been with him for quite a while now, and they're still missing it, which at the same time gives me some hope. Hey-o. All right, let's see where we're going. When Jesus had finished saying these things, he left Galilee and went to the region of Judea to the other side of the Jordan. Okay, here's our little handy-dandy map. He has been up in Galilee for pretty much, well, for all of Matthew right now. I mean, he has gone over into the Decapolis and things like that. We do know from other Gospels that he has been down to Jerusalem, but not in Matthew. Not in Matthew. But now he's going to be moving from Galilee down into Judea, into this area down in here. But notice what's in between Galilee and Judea. What's in between? Samaria. Would that be a problem for good kosher Jews? Yes. What a good kosher Jew would do. A good kosher Jew. All right. Especially if they're living up in Nazareth or near Capernaum and things of that nature. If they were going to Jerusalem, they would cross over to the other side of the Jordan, to the east side of the Jordan. They would trace down Jordan, close to the River Jordan, but they would go not in the region of Samaria. Then down around in here, they'd cross back over, near Jericho actually, which is exactly what we find Jesus and his disciples doing. So some people may be thinking, wait a minute now. Does that mean he's rejecting Samaria? No. I mean, haven't we already talked about the Canaanite woman? Canaanite woman would be considered pretty close to, if not worse, than a Samaritan. Although Samaritans were considered half-breeds, so that's a whole other issue. But the point is Jesus rejecting Samaria by this? No. He's going with all the other Jews down to Jerusalem. Why are they moving toward Jerusalem at this point? Not Jesus, but Jews in general. Passover's a coming. Moving towards Passover. So it is in this context of Jesus and the kosher Jews moving down Jordan, down to Jerusalem, on their way of Passover, that we find these interactions. Interactions with Pharisees. Interactions with the rich young man. Interactions with John and James and John, the sons of Zebedee, their mother. It's all going to be in this kind of region as we're moving towards Jerusalem. So he frames it up. He's leaving, and this is significant also. 19 verse 1 is, whenever it says he left Galilee, he will not return to Galilee. Until when? It's a significant point. He does return eventually, but where? When? Yes, resurrection, ascension. So he will not be back in Galilee until after the cross. All right. Large crowds followed him and he healed them there. So even as he's leaving Galilee, verse 2 says, his ministry still looks an awful lot like it did in Galilee. Some Pharisees came to him to test him. They asked, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? Okay. This is the eighth time that the Pharisees have interacted with Jesus so far in the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew chapter 9, verse 11, whenever they come to the side and they say, hold on, why is he eating with sinners? First time they have an interaction with Jesus. Not the first time they have interaction with the kingdom, because that's in chapter 3. But the first time they have interaction with Jesus, chapter 9, verse 11. Then chapter 9, verse 34, after Jesus heals the blind man and the deaf man, they have another interaction whenever they say, this man is possessed by the prince of demons. Although that'll come to its climax in chapter 12. Chapter 12, verse 2, they interact with him saying, why are your disciples picking the grains the heads of grain on the Sabbath? 12, 9 through 14, the Sabbath controversy. 12, 24, the Beelzebub controversy. 15, verse 1, you have Pharisees from Jerusalem that come to talk about clean and unclean. And then 16:1 and following, where the Pharisees and Sadducees demand a sign from heaven. So this is the eighth time that the Pharisees have an interaction with Jesus so far. But this will not be the last time. As a matter of fact, from here on out, it begins to escalate. They start asking more pointed questions. Jesus starts getting a little more rowdy. In chapter 23 is where that'll hit a pretty climactic point, when Jesus just lays out seven woes of why these are blind guides in whitewashed tombs. Yeah, that'll be awesome when we get there in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, something like that. Okay, the question they ask is an intra-Pharisaic debate. It's a Pharisaic debate within their own community. But the text is, or the question is over one particular text. It's Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 1 through 4. Good test question. The debate is over the text in Deuteronomy 24. Let me read it to you. It says, if a man, this is Moses speaking, if a man marries a woman who becomes displeasing to him because he finds something indecent about her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, gives it to her, and sends her from his house, and if after she leaves his house she becomes the wife of another man, and her second husband dislikes her, and writes her a certificate of divorce, so two times she's kicked out, gives it to her and sends her from this house, or if he dies, then her first husband, who divorced her, is not allowed to marry her again after she had been defiled. That would be detestable in the eyes of the Lord. Do not bring sin upon the land the Lord your God has given you as an inheritance. Okay, the debate is primarily over the first line of these four verses. It is four verses. There is a context in which Moses is describing this. But the debate focuses on the first line. The first line being, if a man marries a woman who becomes displeasing to him because he finds something indecent about her. And then it says, he can give her a certificate of divorce. Two different schools of thought on this. You've probably heard this before, but it's a part of the curriculum and I have to say it again. You have the Pharisees on one side, the more liberal ones. They follow a guy by the name of Hillel. Hillel basically focuses on the word something in Deuteronomy 24. So if a man marries a woman who becomes displeasing to him because he finds something indecent about her. Hillel says, well, something or really anything. Hillel, in the Talmud, in Gittin, in the Talmud, he actually says that if a woman even burns your food, you can divorce her. Rabbi Akiba, who doesn't come until about the 2nd century, adds to this and says, even if you find another woman that's better looking, well, that's displeasing to you. Therefore, you can divorce your wife and marry the other one. Marry the other one. This is Hillel, okay? So if on a test question, let's say like an essay or something, I'm like, hey, why don't you compare Hillel and Shammai's different ways of looking at the divorce passage in Deuteronomy 24. This is the stuff you'd be talking about. So if you say Hillel's the conservative one, I'll say minus 10. You know, I mean, Hillel's the liberal one. He is the liberal one. He says anything, really, even if she burns your food. Shammai, on the other hand, is the more conservative school of thought amongst the Pharisees. Shammai does not focus on the word something or anything. He focuses on the word indecent. He asks the question, what is indecent? And his response is, what Shammai restricts it to is sexual unfaithfulness. If a woman does something that is indecent or sexually unfaithful to you, then a certificate of divorce is appropriate. So Shammai, their group, is much more conservative. But this is a debate that's going on within the Pharisaic tradition. How do we interpret Deuteronomy 24? Hillel, way more liberal. Shammai, very conservative. But I want to point out some key factors because these are kind of playing into the conversation that Jesus addresses. Number one, if you notice the way in which the question is even framed, women do not have a voice in this conversation. Notice how the question's even framed. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? The opposite would not even be thought of. They would never come to Jesus and say, is it lawful for a woman to divorce her husband for any and every reason? They'd all, honestly, if you would say that in the company of the Pharisees, you'd get a hearty chuckle. Why would she want to divorce her husband? Why? Because women are property in this culture, in this time. They don't have a voice. Chairs don't speak, do they? So in this context, why would a woman? That's under the undercurrent of this whole conversation. Which is why I think that Jesus' response has to be kept in context. This is very important for ministry as a whole. Because what people will do with Jesus' answer, whenever he says, you cannot get a divorce except for marital unfaithfulness, what they will do is they will pull that out and make that a blanket statement for all situations of all times. What they'll say is this. They'll even take it so far as applying this, saying, well, I know the woman's husband is a drunk and he's beating her like he does a pillow, but as long as he's not sleeping with anybody else, she has to stay married to him. That's not what Jesus is saying here. That's not what he's saying at all. As a matter of fact, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, Paul even adds another little caveat to this whole discussion. Whenever he says, yeah, if the unbelieving husband leaves the woman, she can divorce him. Paul, are you adding to Jesus? No, he's keeping it in context. The question has nothing to do with how women divorce men, because that wouldn't even be on their minds. Do I think it is okay for a woman that is being beaten to divorce her husband? Yes. Yes, I do. And you know what? I'm okay with God and I having a conversation about that whenever we get up there, because I guarantee you, He won't say, sorry, she needed to be a punching bag. And I'll just say, sorry, I looked at her like a child. You see what I mean by that? I don't think we'd have to, I mean, Jesus and I will have to argue about this at all. Not that I'd be so presumptuous to argue with him, but I would be a little frustrated if I'm being honest. Really? You want me to tell a woman just to get a better chin whenever the guy's swinging at her? That's what you want me to do? No, I'm not down with that. So, all that to say, notice in this conversation, women have absolutely no voice, and let's keep this in context. Because Jesus is speaking to the question that he's being asked. But notice what Jesus does whenever he begins to answer in verse 4. Where am I? Okay. Haven't you read? Oh, I love that. I mean, why would you start off, haven't you read, talking to teachers of the law, whenever you're going to start describing something that's at the very beginning of the law? Because he's basically saying, you haven't. Because if you did, you'd be listening to it. Maybe you've read it, but reading something, it's kind of like the whole the Thomas Merton quote, if you walk from point A to point B, but you don't ever experience the walking, did you really walk? It's kind of like this. If you've read Genesis chapter 1, but you don't apply it, did you really read it? No, you haven't. Haven't you read, he replied, that at the beginning, the Creator made them male and female. Where is he throwing us back to? It's a famous verse. What? Genesis chapter 1, verse 27. Absolutely. Genesis chapter 1, verse 27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Now notice what Jesus is doing. Where does the very first place Jesus goes back to? Creation. But the moment that gives all male and female, women, dignity and honor. Notice what he's doing. He's pointing out their initial flaw of their question. Hold on. You're treating women like baseball cards, just buying and selling and trading as if it's no big deal. But don't forget, these are the image of God that you're talking about here. For God created both male and female in his own image. And then he goes on and he says, and for this reason, and it also says, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united with his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This is Genesis chapter 2, verse 23. He starts off in 127, then he moves to 223, which says, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. Now, hear me very clearly. I know sometimes this can be hard to separate through hormones, but this is not talking about sex. Okay? I mean, primarily. Is that one of the possible application points? Potentially, but that's not his point. The man leaves his father and mother to become one flesh with the woman. Notice what he is saying. It's not like you're talking about pieces of property where, yeah, I own this marker. You know, whenever I got married, I got this marker. And this is my relationship. But you know, if this one runs out, I'll just throw it out and get another one. See what he's doing? He adds dignity to the woman. Then he says, no, whenever you become married, you treat your woman not like property, but like you treat yourself. Because you're one living organism in the eye of God. In the eyes of God, you are one flesh. You are one body. You function as a body functions. You protect your body. You feed your body. You serve your body. And his point is, women have honor and dignity. And whenever they become married, it's not that you now own her. It's that now you are both one and the same. You see what he's doing? He's given women a voice, is what he's doing. He's saying the key problem in your question is that you're treating women like dirt. And they're not. They're kind of like, the way that you look at children is the same way that God looks at women. The way the kingdom of God looks at children is the same way they look at women. The greatest in the kingdom of heaven is kind of like a little child, an outcast. Somebody that's treated so poorly and needs grace, needs someone to love them, to cherish them, to protect them. And what he's saying is that, you know what, the grace in the kingdom of heaven is also kind of like women. And you're talking about just discarding them like you do a broken chair. Which is one of the reasons why after this discussion on women in 19, where do we come back to? Look in verse 13. Where do we end up talking about again? Children. It's not an accident. He's still carrying on the conversation from his discourse that began with the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Okay. So they are no longer two, but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let man not separate. So they are talking about Deuteronomy 24, and Jesus says, let's go back earlier. What was the intention of this whole marriage thing to begin with? Let's look in the garden. My authority would usurp yours because it's earlier, which is something oral traditions were all constantly fighting for. Chronological primacy. Verse 7, why then, they asked, did Moses command that a man give his wife a certificate of divorce and send her away? What are they doing? What is their response?
Using Moses' authority to fight back at him.
Yeah, they're fighting back. They look at Jesus and saying, what are you saying then, that Moses was going against God's will? If you're saying that from the beginning, from Garden of Eden, that they were supposed to be one flesh and they weren't supposed to get divorced, and what that God has joined together don't separate, then are you saying Moses was rebellious in giving us a certificate of divorce? That's a big accusation. This is the giver of the law, the key patriarch that led them out of the Exodus. Surely the Messiah wouldn't go after Moses. And Jesus doesn't. What he does is he turns it back on them. Says, no, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard, not his. But it was not this way from the beginning. See, Moses was having to roll with the punches because you guys were acting like morons, Jesus says to the Pharisees. He says, but from the beginning, that's not the way it was. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for marital unfaithfulness, and marries another woman, commits adultery. In context, hear that in context. What he does is this. What that verse is saying is this. The answer is no. You cannot just discard your wife for any reason that you want. He's giving them a voice. He's putting a protective barrier around the woman and saying, no, you will not treat her like a piece of property. You won't. Just for any reason that you want, you will not divorce your wife. I don't care if there is caveats for this. The caveat for that, he actually, in a sense, somewhat, at this point, sides with Shammai, although his whole basic argument goes against both. He says the debate in and of itself is wrong. But at this point, he says, listen, if there's marital unfaithfulness, if the woman is consistently, well, for lack of a better term, whoring herself around, then yeah, divorce is definitely the conversation the man needs to have. But, for any reason that you want, no, she's not a piece of property. She's not. And Jesus will protect her, not like a piece of property, but he will protect the woman the same way that women protect children, that men protect children, the way societies protect children now, but not then. You see what's happening? It drives me nuts. Do I want to keep reading? Yeah, you know. I hate the way we treat divorced people in the church. I hate it. We treat them like they've committed an unforgivable sin. Don't we? We treat them like what they're wearing a scarlet letter at all times. And I'm going, listen, whenever you actually sit down and talk with somebody face to face about divorce, about their divorce in the past, or about the divorce they're wanting to go through right now, you'll realize this whole divorce, not divorce issue is very gray. We like to make everything black and white because it's so much easier if it's black and white. Why? Because then we can control it. But it usually is pretty gray. And usually is the first place I beeline divorce? No. Because I do take his words very seriously about what God has joined together, let no man separate. However, I will say this. If a man or a woman, and I say a woman because in their day it would have been odd, but in our day it happens, is physically beating their spouse, yeah, the divorce word will start coming out of my mouth. Listen, if you don't get your act together, if you don't get counseling for this, if you don't stop hitting your wife, I'm going to encourage her to leave you. Why? Because I don't think that this gives somebody that's a drunk permission to beat his wife mercilessly just because they're wearing wedding bands. That's not... You see how odd that is? Sometimes we make rules, and whenever you apply it to the heart of God, God would be going, really? That's what you got out of what I was saying? You were saying that the women can be emotionally and physically and sexually abused by their spouses? That's what you got from my divorce section. I was trying to give women dignity and honor and protect them, and you keep feeding them to the wolves because of your rules? What is wrong with you? Open your eyes. This is why not one person should make this decision, though. This is why this type of decision is a community one. Because I will say this, you will be in discussions with people, and your initial inkling will be, oh my word, this person's being abused in some way, emotionally or some point. And then you start talking to them, and eventually it comes down to this. I just don't want to be married anymore. Well, that's not a good enough reason. You know, God, I've heard this. You know, God says in the Bible that He wants us to be happy, and I'm not happy whenever I'm married, therefore I need to be divorced. I look at him and say, I'm sorry, show me where God wants you to be happy. Because I'm not sure. Maybe, did He say that from the cross while He was bleeding and suffering? That He wants you to be happy? Is that where He said it? You'll get people that will twist whatever they can. And they've honestly, you'll get people that will just say, I just don't want to try anymore. Well, that's not a good enough reason. Now, if you're being beaten, that's a whole different caveat. How do you deal with this stuff? With fear and trembling, with great wisdom, in community. But don't put a blanket statement on somebody that says, nope, can't divorce. Unless he goes and starts sleeping around, can't happen. Really? Because 1 Corinthians 7 starts to add stuff to that. Doesn't it? Yeah, it does. Yes?
How do you connect like the discipline stuff that was just talked about with divorce for like a reason that's, I just want to don't want to be married anymore or something that's not abuse or adultery?
Oh, they're inextricably linked. My goodness, yeah. Whenever you're having a situation, whenever you finally, you know, let's say for example, they're both Christians, claiming to be Christians, and let's say you find emotional abuse happening from one of the spouses, and I'm sorry, emotional abuse can feel as about as hard as a fist in the face sometimes. I more than once have I gone to another fellow brother and said, "You treat your wife like dirt." And you need to get your act together. And he hasn't done it. So I go to the elders and say, this isn't right. The elders get involved. And we go through counseling. And we're saying, hey, listen, we're here to help you. We want to do whatever we can to help you. But you better, this is not okay what you're doing. And I've never had to kick someone out. But I will say, whenever somebody decides to go through on a divorce, a divorce that the community, that the leadership did not say that was legitimate, we have looked at them and said, okay, you're choosing to disobey your community. And that's bold. Because he does say in Matthew 18 that whatever we bind on earth is bound in heaven. So you have to have, these conversations have to be interlaced. Because you will try to find people that just want to get divorced so they can go fool around with whoever they want. Honestly. You'll get people that their personalities are way different. They should have discovered this while they were dating, but they only dated 3 weeks. And as a result of that, they're having major problems in their marriage. Guess what? Deal with it. In the sense of, go to your community and figure out how to make your marriage work. Because personality differences is not a good reason. It's not a good reason. Is this making sense? How do you deal with all this? You're exactly right by going back to the discipline thing. It's in community. It's a communal functionality. You are having family discussions about this issue. But in context, let's keep this in context. Jesus is trying to prevent this caveat of being abused to destroy women. I mean, I think it can go both ways, but we have to admit that at that point we're moving beyond the context. Okay, we have 1 minute. I'd like to try to finish this really quick. Yeah, let's do that tomorrow morning. Remind me as soon as I start off tomorrow morning and say, we need to talk about the exegetical because I don't want to give you just 1 minute on it. I would like to give you 10. Okay? So tomorrow morning, raise your hand at the beginning if I start class and say, we need to talk about exegeticals. Okay? Verse 10, the disciples said to him, if this is the situation between a husband and a wife, it's better not to marry. Hear what they're saying. Man, Jesus, if what you're saying is right, dude, I'd never get married. And Jesus says, yeah, you probably shouldn't, you pinhead. Because if you are upset that I'm refusing to allow women to be treated like property, then marriage is not for you. It is not for you. And that's what he says. Jesus replied, not everyone can accept this word, but only those to whom it has been given. For some are eunuchs because they were born that way. Jesus will give us three groups. Some people are born eunuchs in the sense that they simply do not have the sexual urges that need to be satisfied by marriage. That's just who they are. Others were made that way by men. This is a little bit more of a graphic way of becoming a eunuch. It's castrating the sexual urges in a very literal sense. Read about that in your commentary. Others were made that way by man, and others have renounced marriage because of the kingdom of heaven. In other words, there are three forms of eunuch. Some that were born without sexual urges, some that took care of their sexual urges by cutting things, and the third is people that have said, you know what, I'm going to make this commitment as a way of dedicating my life to God. It's kind of a priest commitment. The one who can accept this should accept it. Let me say this really quick about singleness. In our movement, it is not only a travesty, but it is anti-kingdom to treat singleness the way that we treat it. We treat it like a sickness that needs to be cured. Our singles ministries and churches are basically Christian matchmaking dating services. And that is wrong. That is wrong. Singleness is a gift from God. It is a commitment and a relationship. It is something that, listen to this, every single Christian needs to wrestle with. We automatically assume that marriage is the right thing, and if you don't do it, then you're not normal and you're weird. And until you get fixed, you're just going to only halfway be complete. And yet, Jesus says, no, as a matter of fact, singleness can be a gift from God. And you need to wrestle deeply if that's something that God's given you. To be flat out honest with you. There are too many people that get married and don't wrestle with this question because it's not a part of our movement. This is something the Catholics definitely do better than us. Definitely. They even have role models in their society that are single. We don't. A lot of times the person that is single in the church is the weird one that couldn't ever get somebody to love them. That's the way we look at them. And that's wrong. Singleness is a gift. It is a calling that should be taken, Jesus says, just as seriously as marriage. Just as seriously as marriage. It is not an illness to be cured. It is a gift to be treasured, to be capitalized on, to be encouraged. And if you go into a relationship or before you get married, you never ask the question, does God want me to be single? You're walking into a possible travesty, a mess, that could end in divorce because you weren't listening to the community around you. How do you know if you're supposed to be single? Three ways. Number one, you be honest with yourself. Number two, you pray. And number three, you talk to a community that actually takes singleness seriously. Love you guys. See you in the morning. Go be single. Just kidding. Unless God calls you to be. Then I'm not.